Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Today, host Elise Max talks with Bobby Bostic about his program, Juvenile Lifers Without Parole Speak, which he believes has the power to prevent youth from ending up in the school-to-prison pipeline. Then, we play a rebroadcast from 2016, when host Latara Smith talks with local appellate lawyer Kent Gibson about the criminal appeals process and the appellate system in the federal and state level. He'll give us a basic understanding of the appellate system and why it's necessary. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now to our recording of host Elise Max and Bobby Bostic.
Good morning. Today I'm speaking with Bobby Bostic. Bostic was 16 when he and a friend shot and wounded two people during a 1995 robbery in South St. Louis. He was 18 when then Circuit Judge Evelyn Baker sentenced him to 241 years in prison with parole eligibility at the age of 112. Bostic is serving the longest sentence in Missouri given to a juvenile for a non-homicide offense. In 2012, the Supreme Court case Miller v. Alabama held that mandatory sentences of life without the possibility of parole violate the Eighth Amendment and are unconstitutional for juvenile offenders. In 2018, the MacArthur Foundation began representing 80 youth incarcerated with life without parole in Missouri. Since Bobby received a sentence of 241 years and not technical life, his case is not eligible under Miller v. Alabama. Today, we are visiting with Bobby, not about the grave injustice of his case, but about his resilience and passion for mentoring and the program he has developed inside called Juvenile Lifers Without Parole Speak. Bobby began working on this curriculum in 2014. His vision is clear yet challenging, he writes, to disrupt and dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline. His mission is no nonsense, to prevent modern-day at-risk juveniles from making the life-destroying mistakes we have made as immature, impulsive, reckless, and ignorant boys that consequently landed us in an all-too-real adult prison for the remainder of our lives. Thank you so much, Bobby, for being here with us today.
It's an honor to be talking to you all.
We're really excited to learn a little bit more about your program, Juvenile Lifers Without Parole Speaks. So kind of in your own words, can you give us a summary and tell the listeners what your program is and what it's about?
Juvenile Life Without Parole Speaks is a program it includes 12 lessons, the most troubled areas that youth get in trouble in. It's really to deter them from making those mistakes that me and other juveniles made and to come to prison. But we chose those 12 areas because those 12 areas of the curriculum are usually where juveniles find the most trouble in. And so we targeted those 12 things to give youth advice to not make our mistakes and give examples of youth that have made those mistakes so they won't make those mistakes. And I fear the youth will listen to other youth or youth that have been through what they've been through more so than they will listen to caseworkers or psychologists, because those people, you fear that they don't understand them, but youth to know that we understand them because we've been through the same thing that they go through. And as a result, we're in prison for those very mistakes we made as youth. So we feel that we can better talk to youth than somebody else can that haven't been in their shoes.
That's awesome. And so you said that there are 12 lessons, and you picked lessons that would kind of resonate and deter youth from making the same mistakes you did. Can you kind of give me some of the themes or tell me a little bit about some of the content of the 12 lessons, maybe some that were super important to you?
For instance, the first lesson plan, well, each lesson also includes homework at the end, too, so you can assess where they stand at in those lessons. But the first lesson, for instance, is called Reality Check. Reality Check basically is it's a wake-up call. It's a call to youth to wake up, because most of the things we do is not reality, because our reality is distorted because we're not looking at the long-term point of view. Youth, they don't plan for the future. They think about today and tomorrow, and everything is about fun, but the very simple things we do in life can have long-term repercussions. And Reality Check is to check youth into the real reality, to let them know that every decision they make have long-term consequences. and the things that they do affect their lives and other people's lives. It's a chapter now called Guns, Drugs, and Alcohol. It's kind of basically telling youth to stay away from those two things, gangs, drugs, and alcohol, because that's what led a lot of us to prison. Joining gangs come with consequences. You also have to make decisions that on the basis of peer pressure. And there's another chapter there called Peer Pressure. It's letting the youth know that they shouldn't succumb to peer pressure, because their peers don't always have their best interest in heart, even though they build these strong bonds with their peers. And as youth, we kind of feel like our peers is the only people to understand us. But in the long term, our peers are not thinking for either, so they don't have our best interest in heart for the long term either. Mm-hmm. So each chapter is covering an area, you know, like it's a chapter now called Promiscuity. It's telling youth to stay away from illicit sex, because if you sleep around with people, you can get disease, crimes of passion come about from having sex underage. It's all type of pregnancy. Anything can happen to youth from having sex at an early age. We're trying to keep them away from that, same mistakes we made. It's covering the every area you can think of dealing with youth. I think we covered every area, basically, to deal with youth and the problems they have today in the world.
That's great. I think that the lessons are amazing. I've been working with you for about a year now on helping to kind of organize the curriculum so we can get it shared out. One of the themes that I noticed throughout every chapter, regardless of the lesson, is that the curriculum really speaks about taking responsibility for your own failures. You talk about that several times. So I'm curious, what does that mean to you? What does it mean to take responsibility for your own failures?
Okay, well, my particular situation, I had to learn the hard way, because when I was arrested, I never took responsibility for my actions, and the judge noted that when she sentenced me, and she sentenced me the rest of my life, because I kind of, as a 16-year-old, I kind of blamed somebody else for my decisions. I blamed everybody besides myself, and they cost me the rest of my life in prison. So it's telling youth that at the time that we do things, we kind of blame society. We blame our parents for not understanding us. We blame society for the way it is, and we rebel against everything around us as kids, but one day we have to own up to our responsibility and our decisions, because ultimately, no matter what we fought or no matter what we're going through, we have a choice to make a decision. And as youth, we rebel and make decisions, and then we quit to blame somebody else. And youth do that right now today. They don't take responsibility. But in the end, we all going to have to take responsibility. Like me, when I was sentenced, that was my wake-up call. That was my reality check. And I was forced to take responsibility for my actions one way or the other. Whether I wanted to or not, I had to look in the mirror and see what I did. You know, I victimized those people. I committed their crime. Regardless if I felt I deserved as much time or not, I still did something to those people, and I had to suffer for it. So my lesson is to just take responsibility for your actions, because no matter who you blame, in the end, you're responsible for your own decision.
Is there a particular moment that you can hearken back to where you decided that you wanted to take responsibility, or where you decided that you wanted to use your story in a way to benefit other youth? Was there a moment that happened, or did it kind of build up over time?
Well, you can say it's both, but particularly my mother had died in 2000. That was my fifth year into prison. I was 21. She was 42 when she died. It made me, you know, think about all the things that I had did to hurt her by not listening to her. I couldn't tell her I was sorry no more because she wasn't hurt. I wanted to try to show her I had changed, to make her proud of me, and, you know, to see me become a better person. But she didn't live to see that day. So I had to take responsibility. It's a burden on you when you lose somebody like that and you can't tell me sorry. You can't apologize for what you did. And that made me take full responsibility, because I couldn't tell her I was sorry. I had to take responsibility with myself. Like, she's gone now. I can't say I'm sorry. She's the only person in the world I wanted to really make that proud, to show her that all the sacrifices wasn't in vain. But she's not here no more. So, but I live by her example of things. All the advice she tried to give me to take responsibility for my actions, to do the things she said to do, I wish I could have listened to her then, but she's not here. So, kids, I don't want them to have to go through something traumatic like that, to lose their parent or to lose their own life or lose somebody they're close with because they don't listen. And it's like these people who we don't listen to is the people who care about us more than anybody in the world. But these are very people who we rebel against and think that they don't know what they're talking about. And when we lose them or lose our life to prison or to death, then we realize, but it's too late. So my goal is to reach the youth before it's too late, because if somebody could have reached me, I would be in my situation. So my goal is to reach those kids who people feel like there's no hope for them. People feel like they won't listen, but they will listen if they were talked to in the right way, or somebody really can understand what they're going through, because that's how I felt as a youth. I felt that it was me against the world. Nobody understood what I was going through, so I know how kids think. I know how they feel, because that's how I felt. And you feel like you don't care, you feel like you're not living for nothing, or life just seems worse than it really is. But you have to go through something to realize that life is precious and there's opportunities out there if you look for them. You know, that's all in the lessons. I just include a lot of that in there, because it's a lot that we don't listen to as youth or think that we know the answer to, we don't.
Just a reminder to our listeners, you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Elise. I'm here today with Bobby Bostick, and we're talking about his youth mentoring program called Juvenile Lifers Without Parole Speaks. Bobby, you say that your vision for Juvenile Lifers Without Parole Speaks is to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline. What does that mean to you, given your situation?
The school-to-prison pipeline, It's the saying or the theory that, you know, when youth are not given proper education and things like that, it leads to them coming to prison. And statistics show that, you know, like if youth drop out of high school or middle school, they end up, you know, doing delinquent activities, coming to prison. It leads to first starts a juvenile, then they come to prison. It becomes an ongoing, repeated cycle. So when I say I want to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, it's that when I came to prison, I got my education in prison. I came here as a 16-year-old, only had an 8th-grade education. So now I'm on my associate's degree and things like that. It took for me to come to prison to get my education. So I want the youth to know how important education is, and because if they don't get the education, they will revert to delinquent activity that will lead them to prison. That's the school-to-prison pipeline. When you ain't in school, you out on the streets doing something you're not supposed to do, and you initiate into gangs and bad influence that leads you to prison. So I want to tell youth how important education is, not from a theoretical point of view, but for somebody to live his experience that had to come to prison to realize how important education was. So when I tell them that, I feel that they can be able to listen to us in this situation, because we came to prison, none of us had a high school education, but when we came here, we realized how important education was, and we do all we can to get educated now. So I want to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, where kids have to get in trouble and then come to prison, straight from school to prison. Most of us left from high school straight to prison. That's in here as juveniles. So we understand what you're going through or why they feel like the education system doesn't understand them, because in school, the things you learn, it doesn't seem relevant to your future. The things that you're experiencing on the streets, crime, violence, and all that, the things you learn in school about history, as a youth, sometimes you feel like it's irrelevant. But I want to let the kids know that it's very important, even though they can't see it now, because schools seem outdated to a lot of kids, but it's very important that they get that education. It's very important they learn history. And I got to explain to them why they need that history, why they need that education, why they need to learn math, because you feel like some of that stuff is irrelevant. They feel like it won't help them. It doesn't have nothing to do with their day-to-day experiences, but they need to know that it does have something to do with their day-to-day experience in the future, and they need the education.
I wonder, too, when you were in school or, you know, in 1995, what kind of mentoring, if any, was available to you?
Honestly, it was. I didn't see it. My mentor was the drug dealers. That was my mentors, the gang members, the people that was in the streets, them was my only mentors. I never had no after school programs or nothing that I went to, because I was gravitating to the streets. Like, that's what youth do. We kind of, you know, we gravitate to rap music, the street, that culture. And so I didn't have no mentors, for real. That's what a lot of youth lacking.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And one of your lessons, you know, the title of it really strikes me. It's lesson 8 is called Fun is Not Worth Dying For. And it really strikes me because a lot of us would take that for granted as being somewhat obvious. So can you tell me a little bit about that lesson? Like, why did you choose that particular title?
Because, like, if you turn on the news right now and you see in St. Louis in particular, in the last 4 months, you had you had at least over 20 kids that was under 17 that died. If you look at the St. Louis News, each one of those kids, for one reason.
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
They were somewhere, maybe at a party that their mother told them they shouldn't go to, or they was in a high-speed chase, stolen car or something that they shouldn't have been in the car in the first place. They was trying to have fun, you know, like if your mother tell you shouldn't hang with this crowd, or you shouldn't be doing it, they was trying to have fun. Some of those deaths was tragic accidents or mistaken identity or drive-by shootings, but the youth that was in trouble, that was doing something they shouldn't have been doing, they was trying to have fun. And in the process, they ended up dying.
Yeah.
For us in prison, when I say fun, it's not worth dying for. Some of us used to be gang members, so to us, that lifestyle was fun. But every time we put on the color and stand on the corner, we wished to get our life killed, but we didn't care. But that was fun to us. The things that we do come with those consequences. We can die. Or it's not worth dying and getting a life without or being sentenced to 240 years prison. It's not worth that fun. It's not worth it. You know, like what I'm in here for, it was a crime that happened in a five-minute span, but they caused me the rest of my life. But that night, I was high off drugs, drunk off alcohol, and I called myself having fun. But that fun cost me my life, so fun is not worth dying for. I'm a living testament to that I was sentenced to die in prison for me having a night of fun, or what I felt was fun, but it was at other people's expenses. We having fun at other people's expense, that means we are hurting somebody else, and we call that fun, but we suffer those consequences. And that fun is definitely not worth dying for.
That's really powerful, and it is so important for the youth to hear that and the consequences that are very real that you're experiencing today. This is an amazing program. I'm curious, what's going on with the curriculum? How do you make this happen? Is the administration supportive of doing mentoring inside? What are kind of the steps that you're going through to get this to affect actual lives?
My plan is for it to be, I really would like it to be implemented in public schools, foster homes, juvenile detention centers, after school programs, any place where youth are involved, after school mentoring program, anywhere. The curriculum, it can touch any youth because youth experience in each one of those 12 lesson plans that I wrote in there, youth is seeing it every area of that. So, administration, I don't know, they somewhat supportive, but the thing about reaching youth is something that you have to do on the streets. You have to reach out to the world and get that curriculum out there because, like I said, the curriculum was developed in 2014, and it's just not getting started. Mm-hmm. But over the years, you can perfect it. I mean, I've been able to perfect it and add more stuff to it. Like the homework part of it, I just did that last year. I was like, if you got a lesson plan, they need to have homework so you can monitor themselves, look at their own mistakes, and assess where they're in life. Also, I decided to write a companion book called Juvenile Life Without Parole Speaks. And the purpose of the book, it goes forward to the lesson plan, and that book can take youth on a virtual tour of prison, so they won't actually have to come to prison, but giving them like a walkthrough of prison in the book to show them, okay, this is what prison is like. This is what prison's experience. So if you ever came to prison, this is what it would be like. But if they read that book, I hope it would deter them from any activity that would lead them to prison. But the book gives them a virtual tour, and it goes into more depth in each one of those lessons the book does. The purpose of writing the book was to reach more juveniles, even the juveniles that don't use this platform. The book was wrote to reach them, too. So I hope that this program get out to as many youth as possible all over the country. That's my vision for it.
That's amazing. So you have 12 lesson curriculum, including homework for youth mentoring, as well as a book. Sounds autobiographical, like an autobiography, and a tour of prison. What else? Tell me about some of the other writing and the other work you've been doing inside.
I have developed several nonprofits for youth, but I haven't found no one to sponsor those yet. It's Juvenile Life Without Parole Speaks. It's just getting off the ground. It'd be launching. The day that people heard this interview, it should be launching. So I've been trying to do this work for years, but I haven't had the outreach of nobody on the street. And the only how that me having been able to have these outside contacts was when my case hit the media and people all over the world heard about my case and heard that a 16-year-old sentenced to die in prison for my crime, and people took notice of me. At first, I was just somebody else kind of swept under the rug until people heard about my case. And when people heard about my case, it was unimaginable to people that a 16-year-old would be sentenced to die in prison for a crime where nobody was seriously injured. And that made people realize, like, we didn't even know we had a 16-year-old in Missouri with that type of time. And that made people take notice of my case. And with that, I wanted to give back. I always wanted to give back. That allowed me to have the avenue to be able to highlight my situation. And then not only highlight my situation, but to try to prevent other youth from going through it, because youth are being locked up for serious crimes every day. They often are misunderstood. You know, the anger that youth feel, the things that they do, the choices that they make, people don't understand why kids do these certain things, but kids are not thinking of the long term. And somebody got to address that, not somebody that went to school for these things, but somebody who actually experienced what these kids experienced and can tell the kids about the long views. That's why I think somebody in my situation, juvenile life without parole, speaks. We are the best people in the best position to tell kids why they should do these things, and we live in the consequences of these acts. We're not just preaching to them about why they should do it. We suffer the consequences of the very things we told them not to do.
Yeah.
We point out our peers that was killed in the street at 14, 15, 16. Everything we tell them not to do and why, we documented the reason why they should do this thing. Over the years, I feel like more people can get involved with the Juvenile Life Without Parole Speaks Project. And I feel like more people can contribute, juveniles as well as people, adults on the street that work with youth. Everybody can contribute. We can try to help these kids as much as we can.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that it takes people coming together and working with youth and from inside, from outside. And I just want to point out to our listeners that we are looking for venues. So if you're involved with mentoring, if you're involved with youth in our city, in our communities, please reach out. You can reach out through the kkfi.org website, and we're happy to help you link your community with this mentoring program. So we are looking for people to help get that word out at this time. We have to actually wrap up here. We have about a minute left, so I want to thank Bobby so much for being with us today. Do you have any last words or messages that you want to...
You have 1 minute left.
I would like you to tell them where they can go to find, to look at the criteria, I mean, to look at the curriculum, how they can log on and download it or look at it. Could you give them that information?
Yes, the curriculum is available online at juveniliferswithoutparolespeaks.org. It is a draft of the curriculum, so we are looking for help to kind of make that better, make that more accessible for the people who need it.
Okay, my last word is I would like the youth to please listen to what we're saying, and anybody that can help us, please help us launch this project. It was nice talking to you all. And I hope we're successful in this endeavor to help save the youth.
Well, thank you so much, Bobby, for being with us today and the hard work that you're doing. And I hope that things work out well for you, and we will do our best to spread the word about your curriculum.
Thank you for using Securus. Goodbye.
Now the calendar for the week of August 12th. Workers at Truman Medical Center will rally to win a union Tuesday, August 13th from 8:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 23rd and Holmes, Kansas City, Missouri. These workers provide critical health care services to members of our community as they continue their fight for union recognition. They want a seat at the table and a voice on the job to address issues like workplace safety, short staffing, and respect from management. Corey's Network Survivors of Murder weekly workshops are taking a break for a couple of weeks. They will resume on Monday, August 26th with Beginning the Journey. For more information and listing of future workshops, call 816-834-9161 or email coreysnetwork@gmail.com or look for Corey's Network on Facebook. The East 23rd Street PAC neighborhood will be holding their 2019 Family Day, Saturday, August 26th, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. in Ashland Square Park, 2300 Elmwood, Kansas City, Missouri. You can join them for food, rides, entertainment, and more. Bring something to sit on and help them commemorate 16 years of counteracting violence in their community. For information, contact Rachel Riley at 816-405-0195 or by email at rachel.rileyla@yahoo.com. My name is Teresa Wilkie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is a replay of a 2016 interview with host Latara Smith and local appellate attorney Kent Gibson.
Hi, my name is Latara Smith. I'm with the Casey Freedom Project, and today I'm your host on the Giles of Justice radio show. You're listening to KKFI 90.1 FM, and we would like to thank you for tuning in this morning. This morning, I have the privilege and the honor to interview a very, very well-known attorney here in Kansas City, Missouri. We are interviewing a Mr. Kent Gibson today. Mr. Gibson, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with me today. I appreciate having you here.
I'm glad to help you out. Thank you.
Awesome. Mr. Gibson, can you tell us just a little bit about you? And I know that you're an awesome attorney, but can you tell us just a little bit more in specific about what you do and your legal expertise and maybe some of your educational experiences and things like that?
All right. I've been a criminal defense lawyer for the last 32 years. When
wow.
I was a young lawyer, I was a public defender in Jackson County. Then I started working a lot on death penalty cases, a lot in the late 80s and through the 90s, when that was the death penalty was a lot more popular than it is now. And the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, I've sort of specialized in post-conviction litigation to try to, particularly in cases where I think the innocent have been convicted, which the DNA revolution has opened the eyes of a lot of people, that there
right.
were a lot more innocent people in prison than anybody in the public or even in the criminal justice system would like to admit. And it's still a very uphill battle to try to get an innocent man out of prison. It's a lot harder than it should be.
Right. Well, let me ask you something real quick, because you said something that a lot of our listeners may not know what that means. What do you mean by post-conviction relief?
Well, and post-conviction appeals are just what it means. After someone's convicted, you normally have what's called a direct appeal, where you challenge the fairness of your trial based on errors supposedly committed by the judge or the prosecution in admitting evidence or jury instructions, things like that. If you lose your direct appeal, then you have a post-conviction appeal, which is called in Missouri, we call it a 2915, where you usually litigate issues involving the effectiveness of your trial lawyer, or if there was some exculpatory evidence that wasn't disclosed, it would be claims that are outside of the record of the trial. And you should have an opportunity, although not always, to have a hearing and put on any additional evidence to support your claim that you were wrongfully convicted. Once that's completed, you have a right within a year to go into federal court to file what's called a federal habeas corpus petition. However, about 20 years ago, as part of the Anti-Terrorism Act, that in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, they've really limited that remedy. It was designed to speed up death row appeals, but it applies to everyone, whether you have the death penalty or not, and it makes it very difficult for a federal court to overturn a state court conviction. So,
right.
And once you complete that process, you're pretty much done with your normal review. And if you're on death row, that's when you're likely to face a serious execution date. And your options, if you don't succeed on any of those appeals, are limited. And particularly the sort of perverse thing about it is both Missouri courts and the federal courts, particularly in this circuit, say you cannot raise a claim of innocence in a 2915 or in a federal habeas. It's
wow.
only limited to whether you got a fair trial or something unconstitutional about your conviction. So that's really and it just underscores, I think, that there's not an adequate process in Missouri for courts to hear claims of innocence.
Right, right. It doesn't appear to be. Most definitely not. It most definitely doesn't appear to be. Now, people don't understand that once, you know, that gavel is slammed down to that desk there and it comes, the conviction comes across as guilty or however they do it, it is quite a long process for, you know, people think, oh, I'm found guilty, I'm going to file my appeal, I'm going to walk out these doors out of my appeal, it's going to be turned around. But many, many, many times it does not happen like that. And people don't understand that you know, what all, how much time it takes. You know, when we see cases where there's, you know, 10, 20 years of people fighting to get out, you know, this is reality with these post-conviction process. You know, I mean, what do you think could help that long time, all these years of litigation, to be cut down? Are you familiar? I know I just asked you what did you think could help it, but are you familiar with conviction integrity units?
Yes. A lot of major cities, prosecutors or district attorneys or whatever they call them in the particular jurisdiction have started these units, and they're basically, it's sort of like, the best analogy I can sort of think of is it's sort of like an internal affairs is to the police department. They're supposed to be insulated from some of the politics of the office, which everybody's got to keep in mind that prosecutors almost everywhere are politicians, and
right,
a lot of people we see is in Congress and the Senate got their starts as prosecutors, and so politics infects the whole, that issues of justice all the time, but particularly in the past with the tough on crime mentality that a prosecutor would be extremely hesitant, particularly if they have future political ambitions, to free someone who's been convicted if they think there's evidence of innocence, because their political opponents could use that against them. I think fortunately the climate is changing from probably at a height of the anti-crime hysteria and draconian laws that were in effect in the 90s, and I think a lot of people of all political stripes realize that we have a broken criminal justice system. But a conviction integrity unit would be a unit of prosecutors who all they do is review older convictions from that county or jurisdiction and determine whether they believe this person is innocent,
right,
and was wrongly convicted. And they would have the power to do something about it, which would be to agree to have the conviction overturned and either free the person or, at the very minimum, allow a new trial where all the evidence of the person's innocence could be heard. So far, at least in Missouri, which has never been on the forefront of anything progressive in my lifetime, and since I've been born and raised here all my life, there's no such thing in Missouri. But we're hoping that at least in Kansas City and St. Louis, they would be amenable to this, because I think it's really a necessary thing, particularly in light of what I mentioned earlier, that oftentimes the post-conviction review process in Missouri does not provide an adequate forum for someone to litigate their innocence in the courts. So I think that would be a very, very worthwhile thing to have in every major city, and
right,
for that matter, in every county in the state, although they wouldn't have the manpower to do that in smaller counties.
Right, right.
Perhaps the Attorney General's office could get involved in that sort of situation. But that's catching on, and I think it's in light of the fact that everybody knows now that there are some studies that say as many as, you know, 5 or 10% of everyone in prison are innocent.
Right.
And when you have that level of error, if it's 4 out of 100 or 8 out of 100, there's got to be something in the system to rectify these mistakes.
Right. Well, you know, that is one, you know, as an advocate for the wrongly convicted and having a very dear friend that's wrongly convicted and in prison, you know, pushing for the Conviction Integrity Unit is most definitely something that, you know, I have 100% stood behind. And it was shocking to me when I came here to Missouri and began to speak with state reps and, you know, different individuals about Conviction Integrity Units. No one knew about it. No one was familiar with them at all. And, you know, I would not have even known about a Conviction Integrity Unit had I not had connection to the unit that was in Dallas that was established by Craig Watkins there. He has a very, very, he started a very successful Conviction Integrity Unit that has been responsible for releasing several individuals there in Texas who were wrongly convicted. And, you know, we are hoping and praying that, you know, we will be able to, you know, get one of those units established here, because it's very important. It not only can cut back on some time, but it can also save some expenses, because many of the people that are wrongly convicted that are sitting in prison, you know, they already, you know, if you're lacking resources to have money on your books and get the things that you need in prison and make phone calls, and you're most definitely lacking financial resources to retain, you know, an attorney to fight all of this post-conviction and relief, because we know that it can be, you know, very costly. So we're hoping and praying and believing that our prosecutor's office here will be open, you know, to the implementation of a Conviction Integrity Unit and be that lead, you know, be that lead for the other counties in Missouri to say, look, we took it on first and look what we're doing. Look at the difference that we're making in the lives of those that are here in Jackson County. Because, you know, you also have to understand that it not only costs the person who's wrongly convicted quite a bit of money to fight, you know, all of the post-conviction relief, but it costs us taxpayers a lot of money to house these people who are wrongly convicted. We're paying for nothing. And so I just see it could be a win-win for everyone, most definitely. Now, Mr. Gibson, do different circuit or district courts use different proceedings to inform their rulings?
Well, in Missouri, if you complete your normal post-conviction process and lose, then there's the only real avenue you have is the old common law writ of habeas corpus that Missouri follows. You have to start out and file in the circuit where you're incarcerated, and then you can take it to the Court of Appeals and then to the Missouri Supreme Court. The problem with it is that it's a totally discretionary writ, and
right.
The courts don't have to hold hearings. They don't even have to, in most cases, even issue a written opinion explaining why or why your case lacks merit or does have merit. They usually just issue one-line orders denying the petition, and that really gives you very little mechanism. You don't have a right to appeal. You just file it in the next highest court. And from my experience, it's frustrating, and I've seen it time and time again.
Right.
Is you'll have a very, very strong case. So you'll file a very detailed petition with a lot of affidavits and statements from new witnesses or witnesses who did testify, who admit they lied in court or were pressured by the police or prosecutors to lie. And you'll file the petition. I had one recently where I filed a very detailed case. All the witnesses against this man have recanted. I filed it in the Court of Appeals on a Tuesday afternoon.
Well,
and by
I heard about
10
that.
O'clock the next morning, they'd issued
denied.
A one-line denial. And it wouldn't have been humanly possible unless the court or their law clerks had pulled an all-nighter for them to have carefully reviewed this case. And it's maddening to think that someone in that situation would not get more of a fair process to prove their innocence.
Well, in a situation like that, because I most definitely know the individual you're referring to, what would be his next option?
Well, now since he's lost in the Court of Appeals, the only place he has left to go is the Missouri Supreme Court.
Okay.
And at least they do not do that. And from my experience, all three of the intermediate Court of Appeals, the one in St. Louis, the one here in Kansas City, and the one in Springfield, the Southern District, I've had the same experience in all three of them. You could file a petition, and less than 24 hours later, it's denied in a one-sentence order with no explanation as to why they took the action they took. And then there's, when they don't write an opinion, there's really nothing for a higher court to review. So it makes it a very you don't know whether they denied it on a procedural technicality or if they denied it because they weren't convinced that you had enough to prove your innocence, but there's no way of knowing, and you don't have any right to a hearing. And at the process at the circuit court level, there's a practice that is being challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that may be heard out of, I believe, Alabama or Florida, where the attorney generals prepare the orders for the judge to sign denying the petition, and it's just basically a rubber stamp. And the counties where prisons are housed, I think the circuit judges are pretty jaded because they do get a lot of frivolous prison litigation, but I think because of that, they're not, it impacts the way they look at even guys who have very strong cases that they were wrongfully convicted, and they have what they call prison dockets, and one day a month they'll shoot through all these prisoner cases, and more often than not the attorney general will be asked to draft an order for the judge to sign, and that's what happens. And if ordinary civil litigants were treated the way convicts are in their challenges to their convictions, there'd be calls for impeachment of judges and
right.
all sorts of outrage. But of course, prisoners don't have lobbyists, so like trial lawyers and corporations, and they can get away with a double standard of treating convicts unfairly when they try to challenge their convictions.
Right, right. Well, everyone, you are listening to the Jaws of Justice radio show. I'm your host, Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project. Today, I am interviewing Mr. Kent Gibson. He is a local attorney here in Kansas City, Missouri. And we are just speaking on the subject of post-conviction relief and all of these different types of motions and things that are filed in order to help those who are wrongly convicted to have their issues addressed in court with the possibility of them being released from prison. So we thank you all for tuning in. Mr. Gibson, now, there has been quite a bit, you know, we've had a lot of people that have been being released throughout various cities. I mean, if you know, I don't know if you're on Facebook quite a bit, but it seems like every week you've got two or three people who their cases are being overturned. You know, we have individuals that are being released through conviction integrity units. We've had some, you know, prosecutors or judges that said, you know what, hey, you know, enough is enough. Reverse the conviction, you know. I mean, and we're seeing a lot of it, and I, you know, it's kind of we're happy, but it's also kind of like, wow, what's going on when you see all these cases where individuals are in prison for 20 years, 25 years, you know, and they've been saying from day one, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. And some of these are actually coming through, you know, from the other innocence projects and things like that. But a lot of them are coming as a result of the conviction integrity unit. So we don't have very, very we don't have a lot of time left. So I wanted to ask you, I want you to kind of recap a few things. And most definitely, I need you to give out your information in case we have someone listening that wants to contact your office for assistance with their loved one's case and wrongful conviction.
Yes, there was just a case in the Sunday Star today of a guy in Texas who was exonerated, and he's been in since the early 90s, and the prosecutors and the police pressured his co-defendants to lie on him because they were promised probation, and then as soon as they reneged on that and sent them to prison as well, they recanted. But it took him 23 years to be exonerated, which that's just unacceptable.
Did he come through a conviction integrity unit, or?
I don't think so. I know it was in Texas, but I don't think it was in Dallas. But
okay.
I think there ought to be a way, and I think either through the legislation or the Missouri Supreme Court can amend their rules of criminal procedure or post-conviction procedure to allow someone who has a claim of innocence to actually file a motion or a petition in the court that convicted him.
Right.
And have a hearing, and if that hearing is denied, if post-conviction relief or a new trial is denied, he ought to have the right to appeal it to Missouri appellate courts. Without that sort of process, in Missouri, it's a crapshoot as to whether someone who's wrongfully convicted can get a fair hearing and get released. I think, for instance, the Ryan Ferguson case, the guy who's now got a new MTV show, I think if he hadn't come from a fairly prosperous family
and spent
a lot of money, and then also did a very extensive media campaign.
Exactly.
He probably would still be in prison.
Right.
And of course, you know, it doesn't hurt that he is not a minority or someone
exactly.
from the city who has no resources and is a lot of people are languishing in prison, and they don't have family or loved ones with the resources to attack the conviction. And the Innocence Projects in Missouri and throughout the country do the best they can, but
right.
they're backlogged with these cases, and something needs to be done on a local level, particularly in the major metropolitan areas, to allow these cases to be heard and to be heard without someone having to languish in prison for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
Because the last person that I have gotten out was originally on death row and then serving a life sentence from a conviction that happened in the late 80s, and he got out about 5 years ago.
Right.
He was in prison for nearly 30 years.
Right.
And before he was exonerated, and that's just unacceptable.
Right, right. It is. It is. It really is. Well, Mr. Gibson, we want you to get your contact information out because we're nearing the end of the show, and I want people to have that information on you.
My name is Kent Gibson, and that's G-I-P as in Paul, S-O-N. You can reach me. You can either Google me and get all my information from my website, but my phone number is 816-363-4400. And my office is in Kansas City, Missouri, but I do cases all over the state of Missouri in state and federal court, and have actually even done some cases in a few other states. So, but it's sort of there are not very many people who do this type of work.
Right.
So most criminal defense lawyers, you know, go to court every day on relatively minor criminal sort of things, and I specialize in a lot more complex types of cases, and they can be time-consuming. It can take years to litigate one of these cases.
Right,
I've have clients now that I've represented for 10 or 15 years and are still
wow.
trying to get them out of prison, and it's just it's a frustrating process, but every now and then justice prevails and something good happens.
Right, right.
It should happen a lot more often.
Right. Well, we would like to thank you for coming on the show. It's been a blessing to interview you today. Everyone, thank you for tuning in. JT&T for life. Have a blessed day.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is taken from last week's Century of Lies program.
I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Jennifer Hess lives in Eureka, Kansas. She's a medical cannabis patient, as was her late husband, Homer Wilson. The circumstances that led to Homer's tragic death were an outrage perpetrated by local law enforcement. The situation in which Jennifer now finds herself is an even greater outrage that is again being perpetrated by law enforcement. I spoke with Jennifer recently. Here's her story in her own words.
On the evening of May 24th, it was about 10:30 at night, my eldest son, who's 15, had gone to bed already. My younger son, who is 11, and my husband and I were just sitting in the living room watching TV, minding our own business, and there was a knock at the door. Well, I didn't have my porch light working at the time, the bulb had burned out. I couldn't really see who was out there through the window, so I just cracked the door open. I wasn't fully dressed. So, I wasn't trying to show them everything, whoever was out there. And I opened the door. There were four Greenwood County police officers. They said that someone had reported screaming coming from my house, which there wasn't. And I let them know that there was no screening coming from my house and went to close the door. At that time, they forced the door open. Two of them entered the house, and they demanded I go outside with the other two. So they made me go out there. I had asked them to just let me get a bra on, and they wouldn't even do that. So they ended up booking me kind of exposed. But anyways, they out there and Mirandized me and cuffed me and would not let me back into the house for any reason. They had asked my husband some questions and apparently my son. And then they brought my husband out and cuffed and Mirandized him and booked us both in the jail. The jail conditions were absolutely horrible. There were 9 women packed in a cell made for 6 women. We were sleeping on the floor, sometimes even blocking the doorway, which would seem like a fire hazard to me. And on the day of June 7th, I was getting ready to bond out, and the sheriff and a KBI agent took me into the interview room and let me know that my husband had had a medical emergency and didn't make it.
Homer Wilson is in fact dead. Jennifer Hess, his wife, is out on $50,000 bond for marijuana. I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.